Hey everyone, this is the Patreon preview for the Elizabeth Gurley Flynn series part 3. If you want the full thing, become a patron at patreon.com/workstoppage. It is the only way that we get any funding for doing all of the work of putting this all together and doing the whole show and everything. So we genuinely, genuinely appreciate it when you support us again at patreon.com/workstoppage. Otherwise, we hope that you enjoy this preview and solidarity.
If you've heard of Elizabeth Gurley Flynn at all, it's likely because of her pivotal role in organizing the successful fight of the Lawrence Mill workers alongside other IWW leaders. The strike would launch her into national prominence and cement her legacy as one of the most fiery, militant, and effective labor organizers of that era.
Also, one of the most prolific photos of her at this particular strike, which I have had to avoid for the last couple of episodes because, you know, I really wanted to use that photo for this one.
Yeah, absolutely. And so, you know, while Elizabeth did, you know, eventually take up leadership of the organizing of the strike and is largely the organizer most associated with it, actually, it was Joe Ettore and Arturo Giovannitti, who were actually the first IWW organizers to arrive in Lawrence and help after the small IWW local there called for aid, selected partially due to the fact that the largest of the 25 different nationalities among the striking workers was Italians. And so at the beginning of this strike, you know, 30,000 textile workers walked out under the banner, "Better to starve fighting than starve working."
Gene, honestly, I hate to stop every time I hear a badass slogan, but that one's great. I mean, that has like real Kurt Vonnegut energy a little bit to it. Like, it's some heat there.
Yeah, well, it also, I mean, it reminds me so much of the other, you know, stuff that we talked about during the women in U.S. labor history series during these sorts of strikes, where the women workers who were out striking would basically call the workers, be like, "Yeah, if you're out here, you won't get paid, but you're not getting paid enough to eat in there, and you're getting TB while you're in there. At least out here, we have fresh air."
Oh, yeah, I remember that one.
So, yeah, no, I mean, it's a very simple but brilliantly effective way to explain exactly why the strike is so necessary. And so the two Italian organizers from the IWW quickly moved to arrange for interpreters to enable mass communication among all the striking workers and held mass meetings to elect a strike committee. But shortly after their arrival in the city, their plans were thrown into chaos when Ettore and Giovannitti were arrested on January 30th on frame-up charges after a woman worker, Anna Lopizzo, was killed by police during a melee. You'll notice in there, at no point is there actually a crime committed by the two guys that were arrested in that sentence.
Mm-hmm. Right.
They were charged with inciting a riot with their speeches to the workers and being responsible for her being killed by the police.
"Look what you made me do," essentially.
Literally. Yeah. Yeah. It is exactly that.
Yeah. It's wild. And so, but again, this is not only like obviously Lawrence being a mill town, and like obviously all town governments are governed by capital, but to a more perhaps intense, direct, and brazen way in these towns, which are entirely reliant on one industry. And so, you know, you saw like a lot of really heavy-handed repression in these towns against any sort of organizing, much less the additional repression they were able to get away with by, you know, smearing everybody working with the IWW as, you know, "They're a bunch of Reds. They're a bunch of criminal and anarcho-syndicalists," and all this stuff.
Yeah, so, I mean, we're going to see not only that charge repeated here, but even, I think, a new one. We hear a new one in this episode.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's they got creative with it in this period. And so after Ettore and Giovannitti were arrested on these false charges, the IWW organizers in town who took up their roles in their stead cabled the national organization to send as many organizers as possible. And they included specific requests to send Big Bill Haywood and Elizabeth Gurley Flynn.
The big guns, essentially.
Yeah.
Yeah, I love how they're just like, "Send us the labor A team."
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so by this point, 1,400 state militia had been brought in to repress the strikers and protect the mills and their scabs. Flynn described the reign of terror they established by occupying Lawrence in her autobiography.
Quote, "The militiamen were mostly native-born white-collar workers and professionals from other parts of the state who openly showed their contempt for the foreign-born strikers. Colonel Sweetser, their commander, banned a mass funeral for Anna Lopezo. He ordered the militia not to salute the American flag when it was carried by strikers." Pausing here. Wow. They like deeply nationalistic, but if the strikers are holding it, no.
I mean, it's also just like unbelievably petty.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. This is such a funny contradiction to me.
Yeah.
Like your class ideology is clashing with your nationalism, which is also a class ideology.
Yeah, yeah. Well, anyway, picking it back up, his orders were shoot to kill. We're not looking for peace now. Many acts of brutal violence were committed by these arrogant youths on horseback, such as riding into crowds and clubbing people on foot. When they marched afoot, they carried rifles with long bayonets. On the same day, Eder and Giovanniti were arrested. An 18-year-old Syrian boy striker, John Rami, was bayoneted through the lung from the back and died. In the course of the strike, several persons were injured with bayonets. The orders were to strike the women on the arms and breast and the men on the head. End quote. What? This is this is really fucking awful repression.
Yeah, and this is like, and especially if folks have listened to some of the details from like that we went into in the other episodes, like this is like one of these strikes where like they bring all these goons in to start, and then like all that happens is like the workers yell at the scabs, or they'll throw like snowballs or chunks of ice at them, and then the fucking militia just starts shooting people. Like the disproportionate escalation is like reminiscent, I feel like, of a lot of colonial violence, which I think there are actually some parallels to, because one of the things that really stands out about this strike in U.S. labor history, and one of the things that makes it so important, is that it's such a multinational strike. Mm-hmm. Like, and at this point, this is during a surging period of like xenophobia, backlash against all of the migration from like Southern and Eastern Europe, and even in some cases like West Asia. And so like,
I mean, it kind of shows the way that like the fascism takes that colonial like mentality and shifts it really inward.
I just mean more in the way of like, in the same way that you have the racialized violence, obviously, against, you know, black and indigenous populations in the U.S., during this period, there's these contradictions where, like, there's both class and national, like, contradictions between segments of the ruling class, because obviously this is a process. And, you know, following World War II, obviously a lot of these, like, Southern European immigrant groups that were classed as, or that basically had class relations modulated by racism, and were basically treated as subalterns, would then, in the pursuit of, you know, white supremacy, fighting against a you know, resurgent anti-racist effort in the South with like returning veterans from World War I and World War II, who were just like, we're not going to fucking put up with this shit anymore. And so in response to the increased fight there, you have like Anglo-white supremacists like, shit, we need allies. All right, the Irish and the Italians, you're white now.
Yeah, the Poles, yeah. You're white now.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, and that, what you're pointing to is like this being kind of some of the roots. I mean, obviously the roots go back further than that, but this is also part of the roots of that, because this is even before World War I.
Right, right, exactly. And so, yeah, you have all these contradictions between like parts of the ruling class wanting to like use these new immigrants as like, hey, look, we can discriminate racistly against them and save a bunch of money too. It's great. But then the other ones being like, no, what if we like incorporate them into whiteness and pit them against these other workers? And eventually that side would win out. But like, so you have like different strategies being tried by the ruling class to split workers against each other in these ways. And this strike is actually an incredibly important example of how organizers can fight that. because mm-hmm. like by taking the effort, by really intentionally being like, we're not just going to, okay, here's the largest group. It's the Italians. We're only going to organize the Italians and tell everybody else, you got to follow, you know, us. They got interpreters and they went to every one of the, you know, different groups. I remember one of the parts we talked about, they had speeches in 11 different languages. So like they made the effort to include everybody in this, and that's why they were eventually able to be so successful.
Yeah. Yeah. Incredibly important lesson for organizers today.
And so upon their arrival in Lawrence, Bill Haywood was elected to the head of the strike by the strike committee. And he and Flynn spoke in marathon sessions, being forced to address dozens of smaller meetings rather than one or two mass gatherings because the militia barred them from using the main public common, which you probably should just stop calling it that if you're going to exclude the public from using the common.
Yeah.
And so one thing that I thought was really interesting in her autobiography is she notes how Haywood adapted his speech to be as popular and comprehensible as possible, since so many of the strikers spoke very little English. She writes in her autobiography that his ability to communicate critical issues about the strike in the simplest language without dumbing it down made a major impact on her as an organizer, and she tried to learn from his technique and apply it in the future. She described how workers responded to Haywood.
Quote, "They roared with laughter and applause when he said, 'The AFL organizes like this,' separating his fingers as far apart as they would go and naming them weavers, loom fixers, dyers, spinners. Then he would say, 'The IWW organizes like this,' tightly clenching his big fist, shaking it at the bosses. Workers invited him to their houses and shared their simple food with him, Italian spaghetti and Syrian shashlik. Once, when his life was threatened, the Syrians took him to a tenement home built around a courtyard. They said they had every family alerted and could muster 100 men, if need be, by a signal in the yard." End quote. Fucking cool.
Yeah. But not only, like, what a way to, like, explain things and also dunk on the AFL, but also just, like, the organization of the communities is just really impressive. Something that mm-hmm. I think that, I mean, still exists to some extent, but definitely doesn't always exist in communities as much as it should.
There are women.